Well, hello. Welcome to another episode of Grass Clippings, our podcast that is dedicated to celebrating the positive things going on in the world of turf grass and the people who make it thrive and work. And I am your host, Crystal Rose Fricker, the president of Pure Seed and Pure Seed Testing. And today we get to visit with Jim Culley, the president of Seed King Enterprises. Jim, would you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Sure, Crystal. What I do is to provide consulting and sales to golf courses throughout California, Arizona, Nevada on the use of turf grasses, native grasses, and wildflowers. I've been doing it now for over 30 years. I have about 400 golf course clients that I work with in the three states doing this. 15 of them are in the top 100. Since my newest one, Ladera Golf Club down in Thermal, just debuted at number 87. And they vary among, of course, just as much as the states vary. So depending if it's a mountain or ocean or whatever happens to be, determines as to what the, one, the needs are, and two, how I best help in creating situations and providing service to my clients. I don't work too much with an architect. I do have a few that I've worked with in the past directly. Most of them, you know, they have their vision of what they want the golf course to look like. It's on paper, it's drawn out, it's being graded, or whatever happens to be. So they have that vision. They pass that vision along to a landscape architect or somebody else within their firm, who basically then contacts me and says, this is what Gil wants to look like. This is what Tiger wants to look like, or whoever happens to be Jack, or whoever happens to be the architect on the project, and say, what can you do? What do you, can you provide us to make this visual that the architect has in his head come to fruition? And so that's where I work. But since I also deal quite a bit with the superintendents, because it's just not the project itself, it's the ongoing process working with the superintendent down the road. It might be 5, 10, 20 years of continued service and consultation with them, is to make it something that they can sustain. It doesn't benefit anybody if the golf course architect has the greatest plan and design on the face of the earth if 5 years down the road has become an overgrown jungle and unplayable. So you want basically move it through. You don't want anybody to be to blame. You need not, conversely, you want everybody to get the congratulations of doing the project and continuing it. So that's part of the work. You know, I've got projects I've been on, you know, courses for over 25 years with and consulting with. So, you know, they change, they modify, they try to stay relevant, of course. And then other ones go through complete remodels and completely get redone. So it just depends what the project is.
Well, that leads me into, Jim, what I think is also an important role that you're filling, because there's connecting the seed, you know, where the seed's coming from. For us, the breeding and development of varieties, connecting that supply with the end user. And like you said, you're doing it for 20 years. You're consulting, you're helping with the maintenance, you know, how to make these products work well, and figuring out which products fit for which need and the benefits that they bring. So I think that is such an important role that you are filling, and we need more experts like that in the industry. So is that something that brings you joy? Is that a big part of why you do it? Why do you do what you do?
For the free golf. No, I'm kidding.
Right.
Because I get that too. No, it's because there is not really anybody that comes to mind here, at least in my part of the world, that does this. Of course, there might be people on the East Coast and in the Midwest that do the same thing as me. I don't know. But for me here, it's using my expertise, my background, to benefit, of course, finally, the golf course superintendent, which benefits the golfer on a whole. So if it winds up being a case of, let's say, we'll take a long-term example because you were involved in part of it too. I've been involved with the Los Angeles Country Club now for over 25 years. We'll go clear back to when John Harbottle, who passed away a number of years ago, the architect, redid the golf course. And we came up with the mix of the hard fescue, sheep's fescue, and chewing's fescue within the Barrancas there at LA Country Club. But you came out for a visit and you noticed that the chewing fescue was dominating in the turf stand, even though it was only basically, quote, one third of the blend. So out there, we made that look and discussion like, okay, we need to dial back on the amount of chewing fescue in that case. Now, I don't use any chewing fescue out at Los Angeles Country Club. It's all strictly hard and sheep's fescue blend. There's no need to have the chewings in there whatsoever. You learn these as time goes on. Thing, you know, if you stay with the standard that you've been working with for 20, 30 years, and you don't look at modifying because you don't happen to really take a good hard look at what's going on environmentally with the scenario, it's going to doom to failure. I look at enough of those projects already when I'm looking at golf courses that do fine fescue bunker surrounds. And you notice on the south or west side exposure, the chewing fescue and the creeper red fescue burning out. And then, you know, down the road, 1 or 2 years down the road. And of course, the superintendent goes, what the hell happened? It's like, well, you know, those don't like that exposure. And so those edges are going to look like hell. So you need to really consider what you're using. And the only way you do that is basically by observation over time.
Exactly. That is why I like to go and travel and make some of those site visits. It really helps me to understand what works and what doesn't work and what we need to do in our breeding of future grasses varieties for those types of tough environments or specific environments. Speaking of that, you are working on the Olympic Club renovation, and that's very exciting to us and to the world. I think it has such significance. Gil Hance is working on that. What are some of the things that you're recommending or reasons for choosing things? What are some of the grasses and things that you're doing there, if you could talk about that?
Well, the Olympic Lakeside course, which is the one you're talking about, is completed. It's done. Bulls work on that one is finished. They just opened the golf course about a year ago now. I was actually involved 20 years ago on another remodel of the Olympic Club, the Lakeside course. After the U.S. Open in 2014, the U.S. Open was held 2012. In 2014, they remodeled the Ocean course, the other 18-hole course on property. And that's where we started using the fine fescues. The glyphosate tolerant ones. Used a big orange soil guard, enchantment in different combinations just to see how things looked. And what we noticed on the Ocean course was that the patches of big orange GT did quite well in the out of play areas, you know, lower water use, lower inputs, all that, and had a really good color to it. And Gil noticed that too. Fast forward to the current renovation that was done. Gil wanted that same look throughout all of the Lakeside course for the remodel. So instead of having a mixture or a blend of that, it was just straight big orange GT on like 60 acres of the naturalized areas. So it gave him that contrast of the bluish green of the big orange GT against the perennial rye and creeping bent grass that the rest of the golf course is going in. That was, and also too for the lower water use and exposure. Olympic Club sits on a 200 foot or more sand dune. It's basically what it stands on. So it's pure sand all the way down. So it's quite conducive to growing fine fescue on also. The feedback on the Olympic Club is phenomenal. The Ocean course and the Cliff course are both being look to be redone here starting in 26 with the same scenario. Jim Urbina will be the architect on that project. And of course, Jim's asking me, you know, I want to have basically the same kind of look, but I don't want to copy Gil, you know? So what can I do differently? And it's like, well.
Yeah. And that's the thing I learned that, you know, they're trying to make as challenging of a game as they can for the golfers. And that's the other thing that people don't think about, different grasses, how that makes it harder or easier, how you mow it, you know, how much deep rough there is. If they get into that, how hard it is to hit out of it. And that's what makes golf exciting, right? You get that great shot that they got out of the hardest area and they make the shot. It's like exhilarating. And golf is like that. Then you screw up the next hole, but
the next shot. You know.
Even the next shot. That's what's exciting about golf. You never know what's going to happen.
Well, and that's another part that, you know, I mean, I catch this from experience and just having dealt with it. is, you know, it's messing with the planting rates. You know, everybody, most of the questions I get, of course, think about thin and wispy. So what's thin and wispy? You know, fine fescues are thin and wispy by habit. Okay, but do you want it playable thin and wispy? Do you want it dense landscape thin and wispy where basically the ground cover? You know, how do you want it? And that just basically gets down to the seeding rates. So, yes. You know, asking those, and that's what I do a lot of. I ask the questions, what do you want to look like? How playable does this have to be or not be determines how much you actually apply of the material. So in the case like the big horn at the Olympic Club, it's 50 pounds per acre, basically 1 pound per thousand we went out at for that golf course. Others, I'll go as high as 125 pounds per acre. But for that project, it was 50 pounds because we still wanted it to be somewhat of an open stand, even when the plants were more matured down the road.
Well, the drought tolerance of Bighorn GT, we did a ET study on it at the research farm in Oregon where we only replaced, I believe, 40% of the evapotranspiration per week and found that it had the highest drought tolerance, able to keep its color with less water. And then we put it into the turfgrass water conservation trials and it became qualified for that. So we do know, it has super high drought tolerance and keeps color. Whereas a lot of fine fescues, part of their drought tolerance is they go off color and go dormant, but it's able to keep that blue color. So that is kind of unique about it. But the other thing that you mentioned that's unique is the glyphosate tolerance. And I want to talk a little bit about that. Do you see that as an effective tool that people can still use these days?
Well, it's a tool in our arsenal. You know, the application rate, our recommended application rate, what we use at 16 ounces per acre, is still considerably less than what a homeowner can go over and buy Roundup off the shelf at a Home Depot and apply it to kill their unwanted weeds and turf. I think it's like one third the rate of that. So we try to, but it still enables us to control at that 16 ounce rate, to control a lot of weeds, whether it kills them or acts as a plant growth regulator and basically causes the plants to basically shrink and or stop growing for a while to allow the fine fescue, because it will overtake a lot of air, be able to overtake that weed or that undesirable plant, is a benefit. That ability to spray poa or Bermuda grass or whatever happens to be allows the fine fescue to catch up and to down in long term outcompete the undesirable grasses. We look at that as a benefit, not as a negative.
Yeah, I think there's been some studies that have shown that glyphosate or Roundup is one of the safest herbicides that we have in our arsenal right now. So I'd rather use that than some of the other things. And we've seen it work, as you say, like a growth regulator, but it can really tolerate those low levels. And that's why we don't apply full rates of Roundup. We've bred them to only tolerate low levels so that they won't become a resistant weed in the future that you can't get rid of on the golf course with Roundup. So there's intention to those.
Well, to give you an idea, I've been going back working with Aurora Gold way back, you know, how many years ago was that? Did that come out? I have a golf course project in Monterey right now that was planted to Aurora Gold. And now we are converting it to Bighorn GT. And the conversion involves application of the glyphosate at 16 ounces per acre to help the Bighorn GT outcompete the other undesirables come up, and two, to kill off the Aurora Gold. And so that's a component. That's an asset there. I didn't think that would ever come into play, but it has in this case. Of course, there's so many other herbicides that we can use on the fine fescues. Glyphosate is just one of the non-selective tools. There's so many selective tools to use that we could use. It's incredible as far as a plant goes. The one thing that I did notice, and we brought it up actually after our discussions at Los Angeles Country Club with you years ago and doing a little more research, was on the Chewings fescue, how it contains the amino acid M-tyrosine and exudes that into the soil and actually inhibits the growth of other plants, even other flying fescues, allowing it to outcompete even its own species. That's what another reason why I pretty well have really dialed back the use of a chewing fescue in a mixture or a blend, just because of that scenario. And that's another thing, to, you know, like say, going back years where you've noticed things over time and then put the pieces together.
Right. Yeah. Chewing fescue is more aggressive and competes. And I think that what you just shared is part of it. And so it has a place. It's very good in shade. But that's the thing with all these different species and varieties, as you are using your expertise, is finding where they fit, finding the right combinations to use. And then us as breeders developing new things that give you another tool, which is reminding me of, I think you've seen our Festuca amethystina, the powder blue fescue. So that's pretty exciting. I think we will have some commercial seed, or you could start using it in trials here any time for trials. But commercially, I'm hoping to have some in the next year or two of that, which is a unique species that is so blue, but has rhizomes, has drought tolerance, salt tolerance, and shade tolerance, and is a little shorter growing. So I think it'll be a cool tool for the future for roughs anyway. We can also mow it too. It looks good mowed.
Yeah, I'm actually looking forward to that. I remember discussing that up at the field day with you and with Justin about its place, you know, to do a small trial, you know, whatever seed is allotted for a trial purpose, and then to place it. I can get it placed almost anywhere and have it evaluated by the golf course, you know, superintendent, and yeah, also by visitors, and on a number of different aspects. One, of course, visually, and two, playability wise. That's what a lot of times when it comes down to. Also, it could be the best looking grass on the face of the earth, but if it becomes non-playable, it's worthless on a golf course. So
right,
I've seen enough of those already.
Yeah, I was in Ireland this fall, and they're very excited to give it a try there in their, you know, low light intensity that they have by the ocean there. So I think we'll do some trials over there with it as well. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the things that you're doing. I think you are the master with fine fescues and natives and wildflowers, but can you speak a little bit about the sustainability of that? Do you see that being long-term on golf courses?
Yes, I'm very politically active within the Golf Course Superintendent Association. I serve as a grassroots ambassador. I'm involved in the water issues and pollinator habitat issues and all that throughout GCSAA, whether it be just locally here in California or nationwide. So, of course, a lot of things pass my desk, or I read about, different topics that come across or different articles. And as a golf course is concerned, yeah, we have to think about, because it's a long-term property, we hope. You know, we don't want a golf course to come online and all of a sudden to shut it down for one reason or another. You look at the sustainability of the property long-term, whether it be water use, whether it be, you know, habitat, whether it be what happens to be, and you plug those factors into your golf course. We have a topic coming up. I was just reading on before we got on this podcast about our, here in California, we passed a piece to the water districts to have, to where they can take reclaimed water and now convert it to tap water. In other words, toilet to tap. It's going to be trialed out in two counties here in California and the city of Los Angeles. So that basically means that reclaimed water that's been going to golf courses here in the city of LA, in the near future, we'll be losing that water to the reclaimed plants that will be using it to convert. And which means that now a golf course, instead of receiving subsidized reclaimed water, will now have to receive potable water, fresh water, at much higher water costs. So they have to look at that down the road. You have a case in Las Vegas where two reclaimed water plants are going offline to golf courses. That water, instead of going to the golf courses, is now being funneled back into Lake Mead, because the city of Las Vegas receives a one-for-one credit on that water going to be pumped back into Lake Mead. What that means is that those 14 golf courses in Las Vegas now will have to basically convert to or receive potable water at a 40% higher water cost. So now it comes down to basic economics. Can the golf course pass along those much higher costs to its membership or to its golfing public? So yeah, those scenarios are there and they're coming quick. So now it's, do we convert? Do we cut back the size of the golf course? Or on most drastic scenario, does the golf course just close its doors? So we have to look at all that. All those aspects are coming into play and they're coming at us pretty fast.
What about ways to conserve water? So using grasses that use less water, figuring out the irrigation on the golf course to make sure it's exactly watering where it needs. Are those things helping or it's not going to be enough?
Oh, no, they've been ongoing. You know, you have turf grass conversions of golf courses that were, let's say, a cool season grass like a perennial ryegrass are becoming Bermuda grass, which we know is, you know, much lower water use. Uh-huh. You have golf courses that were common Bermuda are converting over to the hybrid Bermudas that are much better on water use. You know, it gets you some numbers. It gets you, you know, 15, 20, 25% water reduction just for the same amount of turf areas. Whether that's enough, still yet to be seen. So, but when you add in, you know, much higher water costs coming down the road, it may not be enough. We might have to take more and more areas out of play on the golf course and convert them either back to native or naturalized areas or whatever happens to be to achieve that number that the golf course can sustain itself at for irrigated turf.
I guess the proof will be in how things perform. You know, we have, with the Turfgrass Water Conservation Group, we have looked at the different cool season species and mm-hmm. found the varieties that can save 40. Now we're seeing 60% water savings versus the other tall fescues, for example, mm-hmm. that use more water. So we've done that with perennial ryegrass, Kentucky bluegrass, the fine fescues, and ryegrass. Well, we're going to be doing a trial on Bermudas. And I was just at the agronomy meetings in Texas, and a lot of the universities are doing research on drought tolerance, sustainability, environment changes, you know, climate changes, and what kinds of things we can use. And there were a lot of talks on Bermuda, which we know saves water, but even digging further into that, how much more water can we save by breeding for it? You know, we've bred North Shore SLT, which is salt mm-hmm. tolerant, mm-hmm. but how much water does it actually need? And so we're going to be digging into those things with the Bermuda TWACA trial, Turfgrass Water Conservation Alliance trial, coming next year, I believe, is when that's going to hit. So we'll see. I think we are making strides. And the other part of that is, how do we get the information out there so that the right things are used and less water is used? The education piece, if you will. Basically, what you do, for example, in Utah, they have the Turf Trade Up program, which has gone almost viral because it's so successful, where they're helping homeowners to use the right species of grass and then the mm-hmm. varieties that use less water. And they're tracking the millions of gallons of water that they're saving. And that's where they're finding it's using 60% less water instead of 40% like we originally thought. So I think helping tie together university research, the private companies and their seed, the experts like you that are consulting to give golf courses the best choices that they have is basically everyone's going to be forced into doing things like that in the future. So hopefully we're ahead enough and we have the products that can make a difference.
I have trials going on currently. The links at Spanish Bay, we have a native grass trial going on with five native grasses in single species spread across the spectrum that are used on golf courses for both a herbicide trials. And then once that herbicide trial is done, it'll be converted over to the USGA for a drought tolerance trial. So we'll do a dry down study there. We planted that back about 3 months ago now. In this coming spring, doing basically the same kind of a trial at the Los Angeles Country Club using the warm season grasses, Purple 3 on those, on a herbicide trials and a drought study by the USGA. And the reason why is to be able to see what these individual plants can handle as far as herbicides are concerned that are readily available on the market. You know, there's always talk we can apply this at a lower rate or what happens to be, but no work has really been done on a scale like this to do trials and to see what these can handle. Because we're, you know, when you're talking about using native grasses, you have to compete against Bermuda grass, poa, and some other things. And so you have to be able to control them while at the same time allowing the native grass to grow and to mature and everything else and to become the desired turf or desired stand of grasses. 28, but Riviera Country Club is hosting the U.S. Olympics or the World Olympics now, we're calling it because it's being held in the United States. So I'll be starting trials here next month on wildflower swatches throughout the golf course in preparation for 28 in the color of the rings of the Olympics. So hopefully by 28, we'll have check and know what the different wildflowers are that have basically the same color scheme, and then to do these large swaths throughout the golf course in the out of play areas to match with the colors of the Olympics. So there's ongoing, you know, fun things like that, you know, that take place. You know, that's kind of keeps the day to day stuff, you know, there going. But it's for things to look down the road with and to get excited about it, to be a part of. You know, one of the things that just came up 2 days ago, I serve on a number of different committees and stuff, and especially for GCSAA. And one of the other groups that I follow is the Monarch Joint Venture Program. Mm-hmm. I follow their LinkedIn page. And they posted now that we're looking at a segment coming out or resolution or even a designation to the monarch butterfly, whether it's going to be considered a threatened or endangered species here in the United States. Wow. That's happening this month. They're going to make that designation. And depending upon what happens, we'll really put a condition forward for golf, because we are, you know, basically big supporters of environmental stewardship. We have the Monarchs Under Ruff program from Audubon International, and all these other things. Yeah. But of course, that's what we do separately. If this happens, it's going to add a whole nother bunch of scenarios that we have to do.
Yeah.
It's not so much for, I don't think it's so much for Oregon where you're at, but you know, California is in the Western migration pathways, and we will have to basically comply with the Endangered Species Act if that occurs. And how we're going to do that, we're currently doing that now with Hawaii and a couple other species here in the United States. But of course, the monarch issue will be pushed to the forefront, and that'll create this whole other scenario. Mm-hmm. So we have to look at, on a golf course, we cut down trees. Can we cut down trees? Do we have to provide buffer around trees? Do we have to do a number of different things to help the habitat that currently we're not really in the forefront of? You know, we promote it. We're not really there. It might be thrusted upon us. And then of course the Midwest with its large migration of the monarch butterflies too. So there's things happening outside of us as an industry, you know, whether it be the government or whatever, coming at us that we have to respond to. It's a positive. I view it as being a positive. But by the same token, it's going to take a lot of work for a lot of people.
Yes, and a lot of information, education, and science. But, you know, the benefit is you really have nothing without the seeds. You know, you are literally painting the course with the Olympic rings with color of wildflowers. And these seeds are providing flowers and plants for bees and monarch, you know, all the creatures. People, I think of golf courses as not a good host for animals and wildlife. But if you take one walk on a golf course, you can count so many birds, animals, insects. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's like an oasis. A golf course is really like an oasis in a city.
Yeah, one of the groups I sponsor is the BioBliss program of Audubon International, where they actually, golf courses take surveys of their property each year, or every year or every 2 years, I'm trying to remember now the time frame. But they go out, they have outside people come in, and they survey the species. They survey whether it be the plant material, the mammals, the animals, what it happens to be. And then all that is funneled back to Audubon International. And they actually just did one of them. They just completed not too long ago. There's golf courses that have between 300 and 400 different species of plants, animals, and mammals on their golf course. So they are truly all the ecosystems unto themselves.
Mm-hmm.
To, you know, and actually one of them, a couple years ago is one of mine, the Meadow Club up in Northern California, took second place. It had like 360 different species on its property that were identified. Wow. This whole thing about golf courses just being large patches of grass that are played by rich white guys really needs to be changed. It's what the public, even the golfing public, sometimes doesn't see. It doesn't grasp what we do. And that's where we have failed. And we need to step it up quite a bit in that aspect. We're not a villain by any means. True, we use water. So does everybody else. So does almost every other industry. It uses water to some extent. It's how we use our water, what we use our water for, who benefits from it is what we need to really showcase. I did a discussion back at National Golf Day with my local congresswoman, who I know quite well. And I just point out to her, I says, listen, on a golf course, there's so many acres of turf and all that. But each acre of turf provides fresh oxygen for 70 people. So we have a golf course that's 100 acres. That's 7,000 people that are basically receive fresh oxygen for that golf course. We have 100,000 acres of golf turf here in California. That basically means 7 million people receive fresh oxygen from the golf courses. There's 2 million acres total in the United States, which basically equates to 140 million, or about almost one-third of the population of the United States receives its fresh oxygen from golf courses. And yet 2 million acres is basically the size of Delaware.
That's amazing.
To point that out and put something that they can grasp is what we need to do more. We need to really show, photosynthesis is for what it is, for lack of a better term.
Right. Very well said. I was, like I said, at the agronomy meetings, there were a lot of talks. That's where all the agronomists from the U.S. and around the world come, and we each get 15 minutes to present our research. And there's hundreds of talks all going on at once. But there was a lot of talks on carbon sequestration and the benefits of grass. Even especially the researchers at Oregon State have actually done some really good research on this. And we can put that up, some of their talks. But essentially, grass is a carbon sink for 50 to 70 years, meaning it takes the carbon from the air, photosynthesizes it, and puts the carbon into the soil. I mean, you can't get a better thing than that. So, and it's also a natural filter for things that come through. They've found that if you're downstream of a golf course, you actually have less things coming into the suburban area than if you're upstream of a golf course, mm-hmm. because it filters things so well. But I just think that's why we're doing this podcast. I just appreciate you so much, Jim, for giving us your time today. I think that we've covered a lot of very interesting topics, and you're very active on social media, so we'd like to encourage more people to follow you and follow this podcast, and we could put more things out that way that are science-based, that we can get the word out there of the benefits, because a lot of money goes into trying to develop better seeds for our environment. And I'm on the American Seed Trade Association board, and that's what it's all about, is how do we get these innovations out to the world to make a difference. And I think you are a very big part of that. So I want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Crystal. Yeah, I enjoy my longtime relationship with Pure Seed, going back almost 30 years now with your products. I've always found you, there's a couple of others in the industry from other companies that think along those same lines. It's like, what do we need to put out there to actually be better companies and better providers of materials? You don't basically look at responding to something. It's always better to be forward thinking, to get involved in advance, and because something down the road might be coming to an issue. If it could be salt tolerance, could be drought tolerance, could be a number of different scenarios. But still, the thing is to get out there and to do like what you're doing, breeding for these conditions. We may not be seeing them too badly now, but it changes from year to year. And what's not an issue now, in 5 years, could be the biggest issue to face the turfgrass industry, for all we know. We might as well be thinking along those lines now and getting something out and done about it. I remember when I remember a great leaf spot was an issue in the Midwest. Think about it here in Southern California, any parts of California, really, a GLS, until we start getting it here. Ryegrass, tall fescue, we're getting hit with great leaf spot. Having those varieties that you guys had bred for the Midwest condition with the great leaf spot made it easy to just make the jump, bring it here to California and to take care of these guys here. When that problem showed its reared its ugly head, we have our issues here that the grasses are done for. And I hope that golf courses or other places across other parts of the country can benefit from what we're doing here. And that's what you have to look at us too. We want to share those conditions. And if we have an issue here that comes up, if we can do something about it, because who knows what it's going to look like down the road, you know, halfway across the country or on the East Coast or where it happens to be, they might face it also again. But we would have already done all the work for them and say, here you go. Just, this is what you need to do. And that's basically another reason why I do what I do, is to, you know, do something here, make it, see if it works. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I probably have as many failures as it has successes. But the successes are available, and I could put that out to whether it be my other friends here in California or the Western Southwest, or if I get a phone call from a friend from somebody in Georgia or Arkansas or Missouri or Utah or where it happens to be, or the Northeast, and asking, what have you done? I say, here you go. We did this here, and it worked. So that's what you want to have happen.
Exactly. Well, that's kind of the epitome, I guess, of what we're all doing together. It takes about 10 years to develop a variety in our breeding programs on the West Coast and the East Coast. So we've been gray leaf spot in ryegrass and tall fescue for a long time. But seeing the benefits like that as the disease moves, we're very blessed that our varieties are widely adapted because of that breeding program. It's kind of a convergent, divergent program. But then when I go to Europe and they're having gray leaf spot in their sports fields, and we're able to use our varieties there and benefit that, that just is, I guess that's the reason we do what we do, because hopefully we can impact, you know, the areas that you're working, the other areas around the world, and even locally. And that's something that our next podcast will be like a local perspective. We're going to talk to a local high school groundskeeper that's using our ryegrass on the field and how that's working for him. And so that's what I think is warms my heart, is seeing benefits locally, you know, on your landscape that you're working is such a big one, because California and Las Vegas and the states you're in, I think, are the biggest challenges because of water issues and all those things. But that's why we're here. And I think that's been just a wonderful conversation with you today, Jim. I'd like to thank you so much for joining us and look forward to some of the next things you're going to do. Look forward to the U.S. Amateur in 2025. And I know I need to come visit you. So thank you very much.
You're welcome, Crystal. You're welcome to come down to Southern California anytime. You,